Greetings to the brightest audience in the country. I am Bob Enyart, the pastor of Denver Bible Church. This is Theology Thursday. Typically, we look at the news of the day from a Christian worldview. Today, we look at the source of the Christian worldview, God's Word. Exodus chapter 5, verse 16. And the prophet said, so he was lying, right? He was lying. He was sarcastic. And he said, go and you'll prosper. They'll be delivered into your hands. And the king said, you sarcastic twerp, you tell me the truth. And he said, all right, I'll tell you the truth. And here's the vision he saw. I saw all Israel scattered on the mountains as sheep that have no shepherd. And the Lord said, these have no master. Let each return to his house in peace. In other words, don't go to war, because if you do, you're going to get slaughtered. And the king of Israel said to Jehoshaphat, did I not tell you that he would not prophesy good concerning me, but evil? So he's mad at the prophet now. First he got mad at him for telling him what he wanted to hear. Then he got mad at him for telling him what he didn't want to hear. Verse 18. Then Micaiah said, therefore hear the word of the Lord. I saw the Lord sitting on his throne, and all the host of heaven standing on his right hand and his left. And the Lord said, who will persuade Ahab, king of Israel, to go up, that he may fall at Ramoth-Gilead? So one spoke in this manner, and another spoke in that manner. And you've got the picture, right? They're up in heaven, and the Lord wants to destroy Ahab. And what a great way of doing it. Let his enemy destroy him. That would bring like the most satisfaction to God. God can do it, but it would even be worse if his enemy destroyed him, even by Ahab's own initiative in his own hand. So he says, okay, who will persuade Ahab to go up that he may fall? And so one of the angels up there said, hey, I've got an idea. Let's do it this way. And the Lord heard that. And then another angel said, no, I have a better idea. Let's take this approach. And the Lord weighed that. And they were probably pretty good ideas. And then a third angel, let's continue here. Verse 20, then a spirit came forward and stood before the Lord and said, I will persuade him. The Lord said to him, in what way? Now, just imagine, we've done a series on predestination, free will, so we're not going to get into that now. But just imagine the Calvinist reading this passage, thinking God has predestined that he'd ask them for advice, and he predestined the one would give a bad idea, the other would give a slightly better idea, and then the third idea will be the one he'll go with. I mean, this is really silly. This is really silly. But that's obviously not it. God is creative, and he made beings who are also creative. So we can think up things. Not only can we create a song or a book or some invention, but ideas. We come up with ideas, and we can be very creative, and God likes that about his creation. So a spirit came forward and stood before the Lord and said, I will persuade him. The Lord said to him, in what way? So he said, I will go out and be a lying spirit in the mouth of all his prophets. And the Lord said, you shall persuade him and also prevail. Go out and do so. Therefore, look, the Lord has put a lying spirit in the mouth of these prophets of yours, and the Lord has declared disaster against you. So all the prophets, we saw the story first, before we got the behind-the-scenes flashback. In the story, we hear all these prophets saying, go ahead to Ramoth-Gilead, attack the Syrians, you'll slaughter them. And here we find out that God had a hand in that, in deceiving the king. because it's okay to deceive the king. Now, we don't want to take that as a license to imagine every opportunity where we can just lie. You know, if a police officer stops you because you had just driven recklessly through a neighborhood, and then should you, and maybe some kids had to get out of the way on their bicycles, then should you lie and say, my son's in the emergency room and I'm rushing to get to him? No, that would be totally wrong. But when you're lying against the wicked in order to save life, which is one of the big examples in the Bible, where God has whatever plans he wants to work out, it's okay to deceive. So they said to Pharaoh, let us go just 3 days' journey in the wilderness. That's all we're asking, just for this feast, to hold a feast and sacrifice to the Lord. And that was a deception. Verse 4 of Exodus. Then the king of Egypt said to them, Moses and Aaron, why do you take the people from their work? Get back to your labor. Get back to your labor. And Pharaoh said, look, the people of the land are many now, and you make them rest from their labor. So the same day, Pharaoh commanded the taskmasters of the people and their officers, saying, and Pharaoh's not here talking to the people, he's talking to the intermediary, the taskmasters and officers, saying, you shall no longer give the people straw to make brick as before. Let them go and gather straw for themselves. To make brick, they would take clay and mix it with straw and bake it. And thereby, they made building materials. Now, if you need to make bricks and you're not going to get that raw material, one of the crucial ingredients, you're really going to have a difficult time. The verse 8 says, Pharaoh said, and you shall lay on them the quota of bricks which they made before. So here's our friend quotas again. You know, liberals have been using a quota system for thousands of years, and it's no less racist today than it was back then. And you shall lay on them the quota of bricks which they made before, which, so they had been making, let's say, whatever the number was, 100,000 bricks a day throughout the land. Okay, beginning tomorrow, no straw, still the same number of bricks, 100,000 bricks per day, so many from each division of workers. You shall not reduce it. They'll make the same quota. You shall not reduce it, for they are idle. Therefore, they cry out, saying, let us go and sacrifice to our God. What Pharaoh is saying basically is these guys, they've got too much time on their hands. They're sort of, obviously, they're not working hard enough. They're not hard enough workers, because if they were working hard, they'd be so tired from a good day's work that they wouldn't have time to waste on with all this idle chatter about a false God. So they must be too weak. So let's strengthen them up. Let's give them more work to do. And that argument is somewhat thrown out today, a similar fashion, that Christians are weak. Christ is a crutch. Christianity is a cop-out. That we're unwilling to face our own challenges. We make excuses about sin. We look to Jesus to deliver us. And so if these Christians had a little more good work to do, if we could get them out there planting trees and cleaning up the environment, maybe they'd have less time to go to Bible study. And so here are the Israelites, maybe for the first time in a long time, having their attention turned back to the Lord and honoring Him. And men will always find ways to ridicule those who want to honor God. Verse 9, let more work be laid on the men, that they may labor in it, and let them not regard false words. And the taskmasters of the people and their officers went out and spoke to the people, saying, thus says Pharaoh, I will not give you straw. Go, get yourself straw wherever you can, where you can find it, yet none of your work will be reduced. And the world will try to make the life of faith as difficult as possible. The world will try to deter weak people from becoming Christians. If somebody becomes a Christian, the whole environment around them will try to make it so that he'll just give up. You become a Christian, and people in your family start to ridicule you, or mock you, or condemn you, sometimes worse. Coworkers will make it more difficult on you. And so many Christians have been worked or chased out of jobs by an environment that's hostile to their Christianity. So it could be tough as a Christian. You know, so many buy into this view that when you become a Christian, your life should get easy. You should have a lot of money, never have any physical ailments, the wicked can never hurt you because you claim the name of Jesus and everything is coasting downhill. That's if you read the Bible, that's pretty much the opposite of the life of a Christian. Because in the Bible, you become a Christian, that's when things get tough. You know, it's the godless who very often have a cushy life, are either wealthy or powerful, well-respected. And the godly, the prophets and the apostles, were so often persecuted, even prosecuted, and even to the point of being tortured or put to death. So the life of a believer is not necessarily an easy life. The world is against us. Jesus did not have an easy life. They hated him and eventually killed him. And Jesus said, if they hated me, they will hate you. Now that's some promise. You know, when you buy your little stack of promise cards in the Christian bookstore, that's never in there. If they hated me, they will hate you. But that's one of the promises that we have from the Lord. Verse 12. So the people were scattered abroad throughout all the land of Egypt to gather stubble instead of straw. This is like their Adopt a Road program, where for the next mile, ShadowGov cleans the road for the next mile. That's sort of what this became. And they're looking for anything they could throw into the clay to bake it and make bricks. And the taskmasters forced them to hurry, saying, fulfill your work, your daily quota, as when there was straw. And this is very typical of left-wingers, right? They think, just by saying so, that it will be so, right? The labor force was already undoubtedly pushed to its limit. And then the management takes away fundamental raw materials for the job. And they say, now perform as well as before. It's like Bill Clinton saying, I'm going to add 100,000 new police officers. Then he says that over and over, like it's a campaign promise fulfilled. And he never did that. He might give some communities money to hire police officers. That's just the money to hire them for 1 year. Then that's it. And he hasn't even done that for 100,000 or 100,000 teachers. Or they say, we balance the budget, we have a surplus. They say that so much, they do believe it now. Even though in Clinton's own budget, every year in the forecast, the national debt gets bigger and bigger and bigger every year. Yet he says, we have a surplus, we balance the budget. So liberals could think, just by stating it, it's so. Picture the Jews slaving at these brick kilns, these ovens, where they're slaves and they're making these building materials. That image of them doing that illustrates men struggling in the flesh. Men who are sold under sin, slaves to the world. So picture the Jews there having to, that environment, having to make those bricks, and now all of a sudden, somebody says, freedom, liberty, we're going to get out of here, we're going to escape, we're going to be delivered. And what happens right off the bat? Things get way worse, right? Their circumstances severely deteriorated. It's like if somebody's living in the flesh and they get the notion, let's say he's an alcoholic, and he hasn't even thought about being an alcoholic, but he's just drank quite a bit. the last few years. And then he gets this notion, he's an alcoholic. He says, I'm going to stop being an alcoholic. I'm going to free myself. I'm going to escape from this. And so then he tries, and what happens? Standard scenario, a million times over in this country. Things get worse for him, dramatically worse. He tries to break the bonds of that addiction, and it gets worse. His life begins to deteriorate more rapidly. So here were the Jews. Moses gives them this glimpse of freedom. But in reality, as we'll see as the story progresses, they really don't want any part of God's deliverance. They wouldn't mind having control over the Egyptians. They wouldn't mind turning the tables, but they don't really want any part of God's deliverance. And men, when they're in trouble and they try to deliver themselves, they end up getting into more trouble. Because salvation, liberty, holiness can only come from without. We cannot save ourselves. Enslaved men need God, God alone, to save them from their sins. That's what they need. So the Jews trying to bake those bricks without the necessary provisions is like me trying to be holy on my own apart from God's provision. And I can't do that. No one can do that apart from the Lord. Verse 14. Also the officers of the children of Israel, whom Pharaoh's taskmasters had set over them, were beaten and were asked, "Why have you not fulfilled your task in making brick both yesterday and today as before?" So this is an ugly scene now. The Jewish supervisors are being beat, whipped, for their failure to comply with the quota system. Then the officers of the children of Israel came and cried out to Pharaoh. And this is somewhat naive, I think. Right? Here's the government, and it's wicked, and they're going to petition the government to get the government to give a just and righteous ruling to relieve their difficulty. Joe Scott, who's a dear Christian friend, Ken and Joe Scott. Ken Scott is going with us to New Zealand. They're in the mountains this weekend, a Christian pro-life retreat at a cabin they have. And she told me just, I was up there for the first day, Friday, with my boys. And she told me 20 years ago when she got into Christian activism and she realized how brutal and murderous abortion was, that she knew she'd go to court and explain it to the judge. And when the judge saw that abortion was murder, he would completely exonerate her and do his best to stop abortion. She thought that's the way it would be, because it's so obvious, the evidence is overwhelming, and the truth is easy to see. And she got there and she was startled. And that's happened to, thanks to the rescue movement, Christian pro-life movement, that's happened to tens of thousands of Christians, where they have found out firsthand that the justice system is now just the system. It's no longer a justice system. Now it's just the system. It's a system. And it's just a bunch of rules. And right and wrong have nothing to do with it. When I have a victory, when I prevail in court, and the media asks about the victory, I always say, it wasn't a victory. It was just a random event, mindless system. Because I don't want to give Christians a false hope into thinking, well, we'll go to the judge and get justice. So these Israelites came and they cried out to Pharaoh, saying, "Why are you dealing thus with your servants? There is no straw given to your servants. And they say to us, 'Make brick.' And indeed, your servants are beaten, but the fault is in your own people." But Pharaoh said, "You are idle, idle. Therefore you say, 'Let us go and sacrifice to the Lord.'" Notice how Pharaoh is trying to put a wedge in between God and his people. He's trying to turn the men against Moses and turn their hearts against the Lord. So when they think of worshiping the Lord, all that'll be in their mind is pain and suffering. And they won't want to turn to the Lord because that's a more difficult turn. Verse 18. Therefore go now and work, for no straw shall be given you, yet you shall deliver the quota of bricks. Verse 19. And the officers of the children of Israel saw that they were in trouble. Very perceptive of them. After it was said, you shall not reduce any bricks from your daily quota. Now, sometimes God has to bring people down before they will look up. In Exodus, they never made it low enough because God's people were never ready to look up to Him. We'll see, at moments, we'll think, oh, they're going to believe now because they saw this great miracle and God says to do such and such, and they do it and they start to follow Him and it gets our hopes up. But then we find out, no, they didn't believe. And it was just a very shallow, temporary compliance, some request, primarily just to save their own hide, but not any type of commitment to the Lord. Now in verse 20, then as they came out from Pharaoh, they met Moses and Aaron, who stood there to meet them. What timing, right? These guys are mad at Moses. Pharaoh's just did his best to turn them even more against him. And they come out with very bad news. And the first person they see is Moses. It's not good. And they said to them, let the Lord look on you and judge, because you have made us abhorrent in the sight of Pharaoh and in the sight of his servants, to put a sword in their hand to kill us. Notice how ready men are, even Israelites, to trust wicked human leaders rather than God. They're so ready. Moses had given those signs to these men just maybe a couple weeks earlier. Remember where his staff turned into a serpent, and his hand turned leprous, and he had another sign he could use in a pinch. And they had seen this. And so they had reasonable evidence to believe that Moses really did talk with God, because up till then, no man could turn a staff into a serpent. He just couldn't do it. And then grab the tail and it becomes a staff again. So they had all been persuaded. But now, with this difficult work that they've been given, they're all ready to ignore the sign from God and resist Him. And they're willing to trust rather in Pharaoh than God. I find this in Christians today who, for example, are willing to support leaders, like political leaders, who advocate the grossest forms of wickedness and perversion, just because they feel like, well, we got a better chance if we go with him. You know, if we go with the Christian leader, we're done for. So let's go with Bob Dole, or let's go with George Bush, or whoever. Even though George W. Bush, I think we said this last week, had met with the log cabin Republicans, that's the homosexual arm of the Republican Party, just 2 weeks ago. And he's told us he will nominate pro-abortion judges, and he supports the federal government being involved in the education of children. Now, what job is it of the federal government to educate kids? And Christians and conservatives have realized this for a long time, that the federal government bureaucracy should not be involved in raising kids at the local level. It's dysfunctional. It doesn't work. It ruins kids. You don't have to be a rocket scientist to realize that the federal government is a bureaucracy that doesn't know right from wrong. When it gets its hands on little kids in their young and formative years, it ruins them. So a guy like George W. Bush, he can't see that. He's an advocate, and he has said this. He's against the conservatives who want to minimize the role of the federal government in raising children. He can't see that because why? Is he righteous? You know, Christians, we just heard this. Where did we hear this? Was it on the talk show this week on kgov.com, or was it on our hike? I forget what. But I think one of the Promise Keepers guys told me that George W. Bush just recently had an experience with Jesus Christ and he's born again. And I said to him, I said, you lunatic. I mean, how gullible and naive do you want to be? Every major election, every Republican becomes born again a year before the election every time. I've heard that my entire life, and it's never true. We are so gullible. Like, we so desperately want to go with the winner, go with the guy that might be able to win. Pharaoh had way more clout than Moses did. Just like, you know, the Republicans who say, well, you got to vote for somebody who could win. Well, then they should have voted for Clinton the past two elections, because he was obviously the only one that could win. But you don't vote for who could win. You don't throw your support behind the guy that's got the momentum if he doesn't have the Lord behind him. And that's crucial. And so you support Moses rather than Pharaoh, because even if you win the election, you lose the war. God is stronger than Pharaoh. Verse 22, so Moses returned to the Lord and said, Lord, why have you brought trouble on this people? Why is it you have sent me? Now here he goes whining again. And we've seen a few times in the story now where God gets angry at Moses. He got angry because Moses said repeatedly, I don't want this job, give it to someone else. And then in chapter 4, that was chapter 2, was it? And chapter 4 says that the Lord sought to kill Moses because of how mad he got with him, and he actually gave him an illness, and he was on his deathbed, ready to die, because he refused to obey God, and he didn't circumcise his son. So we'll see that early on, and as we go on into the story, God has difficulties with Moses. And here he is whining, right? We could hire Bill Cosby here to mimic his own Noah's Ark bit to bring Moses to life in this story. Said, Lord, look at all this trouble you're causing. You told me to speak to Pharaoh, fine. I told you it's not a good idea. You said go ahead and do it. I did it, now what? No straw for the bricks. Now we're getting beat up, things are getting worse. Nobody, not only do the Egyptians not listen to me, my own people don't listen to me. And he's like, I told you this was going to happen. So he's whining to the Lord. Verse 23, for since I came to Pharaoh to speak in your name, he has done evil to this people, neither have you delivered your people at all. So he even appears to be chastising the Lord. And we'll take our break now, but then as we go on to the next chapter, we'll see at other times God responded in anger to Moses. And God became angry at Moses. We saw the one time he restrained himself a bit. Then as Moses pressed him, then he got angry. Then another time he sought to kill him. Well, now here he's got more trouble from Moses, but he's going to restrain himself. And he's just going to say, Moses, here's what I'm going to do. And hopefully Moses will go along with the plan.